The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Lots to get to on today's program, as per usual. Quick update on the London Bible Lecture coming up in October. The London PAC right here in the UK. So far for the opening night, Sunday, October 21st, we have 45 people registered. And among them, 35 so far that are non-members. They're not attending church services with the Philadelphia Church of God. So 35 out of 45 who've registered coming from outside the church. And then for the following night, that would be Monday, October 22nd, we've got in total 37 registered, and 30 of them are non-members. And even though, again, it's a relatively small number thus far, we are getting people at least showing an interest from all over the UK. Another one calling in and registering from Glasgow. And we've even had two people register from Munich in Germany. We did send invites to some of our subscribers in Central and Northwestern Europe. And so already we've gotten some from Munich saying that they'd like to come. So another one I just got a personal letter from. He left an email, or a voicemail, and then wrote me asking if we could confirm that he is invited or that he has tickets to attend. And that's another one coming in by train. He doesn't travel by car, but people are making arrangements. And yeah, if I didn't point this out previously, we've arranged to have the Bible lecture in a hotel that's very close to one of the main train stations in London. So we planned it that way in hopes of getting more people, since traveling by train is quite a bit more popular here in the UK than it is in the United States. In addition to some of this feedback, we're also hearing from people in Birmingham and Manchester, places like that, where they're requesting that we have a public appearance campaign in those cities. And so looking ahead, certainly we'll have to give some thought to round two and maybe round three. Well, coming up on today's show in the next segment, or the second segment, will be just looking at this CNN piece in response to India's Supreme Court last week voted to legalize homosexual sex, and CNN has an interesting take on that news. Of course, they're very supportive of it, as you would expect, but it'll be interesting, I know, for many of our listeners to take note of the angle that CNN reports on that from. But first, I just want to begin with verses that we've referred to so often over the years, that passage in 2 Timothy 3 where Paul says it's for these last days, and he talks about the last days as being a dangerous time. The word perilous, the meaning there is dangerous, and Paul is talking about a time when it would be difficult to obey God's laws. It will be difficult for Christians because they're going to be singled out. Verse 2 of that passage, this is 2 Timothy 3, it says, "For men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters," it says, "proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy." And then verse 3 says, "without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good." Notice that last phrase there. That's what it will be like in these last days. People would be lovers of their own selves, and they would despise those that are good. I mean, if you stand for goodness, if you stand for purity, If you stand for holiness, the way that the Bible defines it, then you're going to be singled out. People will despise you. This story from PJ Media yesterday, it's about this PJ Media contributor, and this lady, I guess she's on Fox News on occasion as well, but she sent out a tweet recently denouncing the abortion movement, and I mean, it set off a frenzied response, a fiery response, fiery rebuke coming from Twitter sphere. And she just recently, I guess this, I don't know exactly the date on the tweet, but over the weekend, she came out and publicly acknowledged that she's received all kinds of death and rape threats. And then once she made that known, people on Twitter, well, they were quite happy to support those, not her, but to support those who were making those threats, of all things. And so what was the tweet? What is it that's at the center of this controversy? She says here, this is the tweet, at the root of abortion hysteria, is women's unhinged desire for irresponsible sex. Sex is their god, she said. Abortion is their sacrament. She said, it's abhorrent as women have flung themselves from the heights of being the world's civilizing force to the muck and mire of dehumanizing depravity. She's a woman, and she's saying, you know, we used to stand for civilizing our nations, raising the standard, upholding chastity and virtue. But now we're just down in the muck and the mire of dehumanizing depravity. PJ Media, the article, it says here, as if to prove McAllister's point about depravity, abortion activists jumped on her case, calling her everything from crazy to misogynist to a supporter of The Handmaid's Tale. I'm not sure what that program's about. I know the liberals love it, but you get the idea. It says, but the real danger came from elsewhere. McAllister told PJ Media that she received death and rape threats over multiple forms of private communication. They are threats outside of Twitter, stating they know where I live, McAllister said. Threats of rape and strangling. She went on to say how that she called the police, and they've put her on home watch. They've added a layer of protection because of all the threats coming at her. She says her children are frightened. All because of that tweet. All because she says these feminists are making sex out to be their god and abortion's their sacrament. What does it say in 2 Timothy 3 and verse 3? Despisers of those that are good. The prophet Isaiah, he puts it this way, and judgment is turned away backward, and justice stands afar off, for truth is fallen in the street, and equity cannot enter. Yes, truth fails, Isaiah 59:15 says, and he that departs from evil makes himself a prey. He that departs from evil makes himself a prey, it says, and the Eternal saw it, and it displeased him, and there was no judgment. See, the tiny handful that actually depart from evil, they're made to be the crazy group. You can look at the margin there in Isaiah, if you have a King James Bible, where it says, make himself a prey in the verse. That means is accounted mad. He's accounted mad. She's a mad individual. She's crazy. She's dangerous, this woman that sent out that tweet. Certainly not those people that are threatening her with rape or murder. What does it say about our society? It's exactly as Jesus prophesied it would be, as in the days of Noah. Sodom and Gomorrah, Herbert Armstrong wrote in The Missing Dimension in Sex, he said, since it is a basic truism that a solid family structure is the foundational bulwark of any stable and permanent society, this fact means only one thing. Civilization as we know it is on the way down and out. Unless that great unseen strong hand from someplace soon intervenes and saves today's sick society. We need that helpful, timely, miraculous intervention from God. And we can be thankful that God promises to send that. Matthew 24, verses 21 and 22. He will intervene, but it's going to be right at the last when he finally puts a stop to it. Well, this article about this woman, Denise McAllister, as I said, over the weekend, she went public with the fact that she was taking all these threats, death, rape, all because, as she says here, all because I've dared to call out women who are hysterical about abortion and to challenge them to be responsible and not to elevate sex to the point that they're willing to kill human life to avoid their responsibilities. How sick is that? She just calls them out with one tweet. And the tweet is the controversial act. Not sucking the life out of a womb at 5-6 months along. That's not controversial. It's not controversial what happened, a couple of years ago with Planned Parenthood. All of that video from on the inside, none of that was controversial. Maybe just for a few conservative voices, and that's it. And then people move on. But if you say one thing to this mob on social media, you have to literally run for your life. PJ Media says some people responded with sympathy to the person making the death and rape threats, of all things, not toward her. People don't react well to your extremism, said one individual on Twitter. And then this article gives all kinds of tweets in response to her tweet. I mean, this is a woman who, she's actually a rape survivor. She was raped something like 20 years ago, and she's been quite open, sharing her story with the public. And she's very much pro-life. And she's very much against abortion. And lots of people hate her because of it. The final bit from this article, it says, abortion may involve some perverse form of empowerment for women, but power comes with responsibility. I mean, listen to this, because not too long ago, this was just common sense. Responsibility. That's what she's calling for here. I want women to own their responsibilities for their freedoms, she explained. One of those responsibilities is when you choose to have sex, even with birth control, you have the responsibility to be prepared for the possibility of pregnancy. Yes, indeed. Used to be common sense. You can't just end another human life because you didn't want to be responsible. All because you put a higher value on having sex than on human life. It says here, abortion activists push the killing of babies as empowering to women. Tragically, this is often the exact opposite of the case. As studies have shown, women are pressured into abortion by others. I mean, the real pressure is coming from the other side that's obsessed with making sex to be a god, and abortion is also a part of it, as she brings out. No responsibility, just reckless living, irresponsible living. It says here, finally, even if women were empowered by the practice, the entire point of pushing abortion is to separate sex from childbearing. This involves shirking the responsibility of acknowledging a key part of sex, reproduction. The pleasure in sex in the right circumstances is good, but activists value this pleasure so highly as to dismiss the consequences of sex, even to the point of justifying killing unborn babies. I mean, that qualifies today as extremism. That kind of a position, which is based very much on biblical standards. But as we just read, in the last days, these perilous times that we're in, men shall be lovers of their own selves, and they're not even going to have natural affection for their very own, for their own children, for their own babies. Despisers of those that are good, it says at the end of verse 3. And then verse 4 continues, this is in 2 Timothy 3, traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God. That's what it amounts to. We're living in a world in revolt against God and His commandments, a world in rebellion. Mr. Armstrong, Herbert Armstrong, talks on this in The Missing Dimension in Sex. It's just off the rails. And today, sex, I mean, it's just hurled at us from every direction, every angle. A modern sex rampage, as he said in MDS. We go around, we look for every pleasing and stimulating sensation. Lovers of pleasures, more than lovers of God. You can see that also in 1 John 2 and verse 15. But just to finish the thought here in 2 Timothy, Paul says in verse 5 that it all has a form of godliness. I mean, they sound very righteous. They talk about tolerance. They talk about getting away from extremism. It has a form of godliness, but it denies the power thereof. And God says, from such, turn away. Turn away from this outward formality and appearance of ceremony or religion, and just obey my laws, God says. But that's the problem. God and the Bible, they no longer bear any direct authority over people's lives. And we'll talk more on this in the next segment. I mean, so much of this rabid, hostile reaction, so much of it is in response to the Bible standard. There's a hostility toward God, Romans 8 and verse 7, toward God and His law. People may claim to be religious all that they want, but if it doesn't fit with what God teaches in the Bible, if it doesn't square with the truth of God, it's exactly what Paul's describing here in 2 Timothy 3. It's just a form. It's just a show of religious-sounding terms. But what, like I said on yesterday's program, what are the actions? What are the deeds? This is how we're being judged. This is how we're being evaluated. Jesus said, you shall know them by their fruits. You're going to know them by their actions, by the fruits that come from their actions. What must God think when He looks at our society, when He looks at what happens in just one little case like this, one tweet, and then the reaction? It's so intense, it's so hateful, this mob-like mentality, that here this woman has to get off of social media. She has to basically shut down and go off the grid and then hibernate in her house. And her children are terrified. Talk about making yourself a prey. P-R-E-Y. That's what we're seeing. And God is angry. He's upset. Romans 1 and verse 18 says, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. They're suppressing the truth of God. That's what the Revised Standard Version says. They suppress it. They bury it. They want to destroy it. And well, they're having some success in doing that, but it says here in Romans 1, the wrath of God is being revealed. God's not passive about sin. God's not passive about murder and hatred and family division. We are going to reap what we sow. Just like I covered yesterday, I mean, the fruits, look at the fruits that we're producing in our society. There is cause and effect. And even if you leave the oncoming Great Tribulation out of the equation for a moment, I mean, still look at the effect today. I mean, look at the family. Look at the family. Look at marriage. Look at our children. I mean, already we're reaping what we've sown. And this, as Mr. Armstrong brings out, I mean, this is a greater threat than the hydrogen bomb. This destruction from within. This destruction of the bedrock foundation of any civilization, any stable one. And that's the traditional family, and that's what Satan's trying to destroy. I mean, there's a conspiracy against fatherhood, against marriage, against the God-ordained purposes for sex, all of it. Back in Isaiah 59, this is that same chapter where it says, the truth fails. It fails. And if you abide by the truth, I mean, you're making yourself out to be a prey. And then just a couple of verses after that, God says through the prophet, according to their deeds, accordingly he will repay fury to his adversaries, recompense to his enemies, to the islands, he will repay recompense. See, God will reward us, so to speak, for this kind of twisted and perverted judgment. There is cause and effect, blessings for obedience and curses for disobedience. We'll dwell on this just a little bit more in the second segment when we concentrate on another article, that one, as I said, in CNN, which is commenting on the recent decision in India to legalize homosexual activity. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. Don't forget to visit our website at thetrumpet.com. Every day, thetrumpet.com will help you understand your world by analyzing today's headlines under the clear light of Bible prophecy. Log on to thetrumpet.com and sign up for our daily Trumpet Brief email and subscribe to The Trumpet Magazine. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
Some of you may remember 3 years ago when then-President Barack Obama was visiting Kenya. They had a joint press conference, and it was President Obama there with President Kenyatta, I think, from Kenya. And before you hear from the president of Kenya here, you should know that it was Barack Obama who basically lectured him and Kenya that they need to do more for the LGBT community. They need to promote homosexual rights. And this was how the president of Kenya responded to what Barack Obama had said. This is clip one.
The fact of the matter is that Kenya and the United States, we share so many values. Our common love for democracy, entrepreneurship, value for families. These are things that we share. But there are some things that we must admit we don't share. Our culture, our societies don't accept. It's very difficult for us to be able to impose on people that which they themselves do not accept. This is why I repeatedly say that for Kenyans today, the issue of gay rights is really a non-issue. We want to focus on other areas that are day-to-day living for our people. The health issues that we have discussed with President Obama, these are critical. Issues of ensuring inclusivity and of women, a huge section of society that is normally left out of the mainstream of economic development. What we can do in terms of infrastructure, what we can do in terms of education, in terms of our roads, in terms of giving our people power, encouraging entrepreneurship. These are the key focuses. Maybe once, like you have, overcome some of these challenges, we can begin to look at new ones. But as of now, the fact remains that this issue is not really an issue that is on the foremost mind of Kenyans, and that is the fact.
And that's from a press conference in July of 2015, and what you didn't hear is that after he said that, there were several reporters there in the group asking the questions that started clapping. I assume they were Kenyan reporters who were showing their support for their president, who said, look, we've got enough issues to focus on here. We're not concerned about gay rights. That's a non-issue. As far as the minds of Kenyans are concerned, there's other problems we need to worry about. That's what he said in response to President Obama's lecture. I mean, for our nations, that's like the top of the agenda. For Britain and the United States, we're leading the world as champions for gay rights, for the LGBT communities. Well, as I said earlier, last week in India, India became the latest nation to legalize homosexual sex. And then that leads to this article from CNN. It's titled, "The Homophobic Legacy of the British Empire." So the British Empire's long gone, but their legacy is still there, and don't you know it's a bad one? All of those laws that the British Empire put in place. I mean, it's only just now that they're beginning to change the laws regarding homosexuality in India. I mean, what does that say? What does that say about Britain's history and about the world today? CNN, of course, they're applauding what's happening in India and other nations around the world, while at the same time taking a shot at the British Empire. It says a wave of joy and relief swept through India's LGBT community last week following a landmark decision by the country's Supreme Court to legalize consensual gay sex. The announcement that Section 377, a British colonial-era law prohibiting unnatural acts, would be annulled was met with jubilation by rights activists, many of whom had campaigned for years to end the archaic legislation. But while India's LGBT population embraces its newfound freedoms, millions across the globe continue to wait in hope. It's not happening fast enough. I think of Joel Hilliker's book, Redefining Family, and just how fast and dramatic these changes, homosexual rights, it's been just really over the past 10, 15 years. And here comes CNN, and they're not alone. There was an article along these lines at the Washington Post just a couple, 3 years ago. But it's not happening fast enough. We're happy for India, they say. But we need to make more progress. Progress, the way they look at it. It says in most of these countries, legislation outlawing consensual gay sex was inherited from the British rule and left in place following independence. So when Britain was there, they were the problem. They had to go. They had to leave. And then Britain leaves, and Britain's still the problem. They're still the problem in South Africa. They're still the problem in India. There's a spirit behind this. And then, too, to target Britain of all nations, not Saudi Arabia, not Russia, not Islam, certainly not Islam, but Britain, Great Britain, who, as I say, together with the United States, I mean, they are leading the world down this road of homosexual rights, of LGBTQ rights. And never mind, of course, never mind all of the good that that empire brought to those many regions. That's something that's not even to be discussed. As I say, the Washington Post, a few years ago, I mean, they got in on the action as well. The British colonial origins of anti-gay laws. It all is because of colonialism. If only the British had never shown up in India, it would have been so much better. Same with South Africa. That's what they say. A couple years ago, I guess I got into this last year at this time, this piece at the Times by Nigel Bigger. It says, apologizing for empire is now compulsory. You have to apologize. As if everything that the empire did was wrong and evil. For the last 100 years, Western colonialism has had a bad name. Nigel's quoting from this paper by Bruce Gilley, this political scientist at Portland State University. As I say, you might remember us covering this back in November, I think it was. But it says here, this is from Bruce's paper, Bruce Gilley, for the last 100 years, Western colonialism has had a bad name. It's high time to question this orthodoxy. That's the way he started his paper. And what do you suppose the reaction was? He said, this is from Nigel's column at the Times, predictably, a perfect storm of protest erupted. Well, it's not unlike what happened when that woman sent out one tweet saying, look, you're being selfish and irresponsible. And she's the extremist. She's the dangerous one. And here comes Bruce Gilley. He says, look, colonialism's gotten a bad name, but we need to rethink this. Predictably, a perfect storm of protest erupted. As Gilley tells it, 15 of 34 members of TWQ, that's the weekly, Third World Quarterly, 15 of 34 members of their editorial board resigned. Two petitions demanding a retraction gathered over 16,000 signatures. Fellow academics accused him of promoting white supremacy. And the editor eventually withdrew the essay under death threats from Indian nationalists. Though it survives on the author's own website. I mean, the author, if he didn't have his own website, it would have just disappeared. Because they had to remove it because of death threats. And we're meant to believe that Bruce Gilley is the dangerous one. Here's some of what he wrote. He refers to all of these case studies about colonialism. He says, such works have found evidence for significant social, economic, and political gains under colonialism. I mean, that's the truth. There are lots and lots and lots of positives. Expanded education, improved public health, the abolition of slavery, widened employment opportunities, improved administration, the creation of basic infrastructure, female rights, enfranchisement of untouchable or historically excluded communities, fair taxation, access to capital, the generation of historical and cultural knowledge, and national identity formation, to mention just a few dimensions. But the thing is, you can't mention that. You can't say that. To say that is dangerous. And so you're threatened. You're threatened with death if you just report the facts. That's not to say that everything the empire brought to those regions was good or perfect. But so many of these radical leftists are just erasing all of those positives, and they've given empire a bad name. And now they're to be cursed, the empire, if they're there, if they withdraw, if they've been away for nearly a century, it's still their fault that we're not progressing enough. We're not progressing as fast as the progressives want for us to progress. He doesn't deny. This is from Nigel Biggar's column last year about Gilly. He doesn't deny that inexcusable atrocities occurred under European colonial rule. It's just that he remembers that they also happened before Europeans arrived and after they left. It was worse in so many of those regions before the Europeans arrived. He points to Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe, as a recent example. Look, we need to rethink this. That's not going to happen, though, because his paper was just blotted out. Blotted out of the internet, except for his own website. The CNN piece about Britain's homophobic legacy. It says here, speaking at a meeting of Commonwealth heads of government on April 17th, British Prime Minister Theresa May expressed regret at the British Empire's long legacy of homophobic legislation. And then it quotes Ms. May, "I am all too aware that these laws were often put in place by my own country. They were wrong then, and they are wrong now." As the UK's Prime Minister, I deeply regret both the fact that such laws were introduced and the legacy of discrimination, violence, and even death that persist today. And so, I mean, what do you do when even the leader of Britain sides with those who are issuing the threats to Bruce Gilley and others? The apology tour, we saw it on full display when Barack Obama was president. Apologizing for our history. Apologizing for the legacy of empire. You'll notice no other nation, no other empire or former empire does that sort of thing. It's just the opposite. You get ones like Vladimir Putin coming along saying, hey, we need to resurrect our empire. We need to bring back the glory. Not so with Ephraim and Manasseh. I mean, I suppose there's a little bit of that there with President Trump and his administration because of the resurgence, but look at how many enemies that makes him, though. Look at how many enemies he has because he's out there talking about making America great again. There's a lot of commentators. There's a lot of politicians. There's a lot of academics that cringe when they hear him say things like that. This CNN article, finally here, it says, despite the prevalence of anti-LGBT laws throughout the former British Empire, there was no blanket decree outlawing homosexual relations. Instead, it was the sensibilities of individual colonial administrators which led to the first laws and then their quick spread across the empire from 1860 onwards. Enzi Han, author of British Colonialism and the Criminalization of Homosexuality, said the laws were partly the product of a strict Victorian moral code, which defined any sexual activity not for procreation as taboo. And while, I mean, that was 1860-ish, that was near the tail end of the old morality age, as Mr. Armstrong writes about in The Missing Dimension in Sex, when the church taught that it's pretty much for procreation, and that's it. And then, like Mr. Armstrong describes in MDS, sex was virtually forbidden as a topic of conversation. It wasn't discussed. There was no education. Parents weren't teaching their children about the God-ordained purposes for sex. But the solution to that problem is not to swing all the way over to the other side, as Mr. Armstrong says in Missing Dimension, to this new morality of anything goes. That's like going from the frying pan into the fire, to use the language Mr. Armstrong used. But just go back to the 1800s. Queen Victoria, I mean, clearly she dominated the 19th century, or at least her standard of morality did. She inherited that throne, the British throne, when she was just a teenager, and went on to reign for more than 63 years, 1837 all the way to 1901. And you think it's just coincidence when there was this very strict moral standard? That this also happened to be the time when the British Empire reached the absolute peak of its power and influence. William Manchester wrote in his book on Churchill, he said, before Victoria came to the throne, when England had been an agricultural island, lacking in industry and without an empire. Further on, he says, native drive, wise legislation, an educated and enlightened oligarchy, ingeniously harnessed to genuine democracy, sea power, skillful diplomacy, faith in the supremacy of its island race, these had made Imperial Britain the envy of the world's chancelleries. Yes, indeed. I mean, there was a pride in their power. There was a pride in their power. She came along, Victoria did, when Britain had this constitutional monarchy, so she didn't have a lot of political power, but she did have a lot of influence. A lot of influence on British morality. And if you look at life in Britain, oh, and the progressives today, they would look back on this as, well, the Stone Ages, practically. But the British home life, the British family, the British household, a place of peace and stability. Children were taught discipline. They were taught to obey without question. Manchester says that every story for Victorian children had a point and a moral. And usually it revolved around dutifulness, morality, responsibility. Children were quite often supervised. They weren't just left to their own devices. Left to themselves. The proverb says that brings parents to shame. What a difference. Winston Churchill grew up in an era when they had a reverence for the past, where they were proud of their empire roots. They grew up in the period of empire, and they devoted themselves to hard work. There was a maxim of the day: attend church, abstain from drink, read a serious newspaper, and put your money in the bank. Oh, but that's so old-fashioned. We've progressed so far from some of those basics, from some of those principles. It's not like that society was perfect, or as I say, that the empire itself was perfect. But as Manchester brought out in his book, I mean, a lot of the debauchery back then, it had to go underground. Or it was maybe at just the top echelon, the upper class. But the working man, the ordinary British family, it was intact. It was unified. It revolved around a marriage. The family didn't split apart and break up like it does so often in the new morality. This age when anything goes. Now, isn't it interesting that the British Empire reached its peak in the late 1800s and early 1900s? When Queen Victoria died in 1901, the British Empire ruled over 412 million subjects worldwide. And this was the era that Winston Churchill grew up in. You can see why he was a child of the empire and how that influenced his thinking. Manchester says, he said about that period, Queen Victoria's death, 1901, he said, barring monumental English folly or loss of will or the abandonment of such Victorian principles as disdain for continental alliances, the mere suggestion of any of these lapses would in 1901 have evoked global laughter. I mean, the empire would always be around. It would always exist. It would always be powerful. It would engulf the world. And the suggestion in 1901 that the great British Empire would ever lose its empire, well, it would have seemed preposterous. And yet, look at how fast it happened. How did it happen? Because you see the British society today, and you could put America in the same boat. Do they have that same love and reverence for the Holy Scriptures, for the Word of God? Do you see that same discipline within the family sphere at home? The reverence for the past? Back in the 1800s, I mean, a lot of British families, they knew the Bible. A lot of them took it literally. And their Sabbath, even though it was on Sunday, it was sacred time. Family time. Time for church. Time for the Bible. And as it happens, that's when the empire was on its ascent to greatest ever. Greatest ever in the history of the world. Neil Ferguson, he wrote in his book, Empire, he said, the Victorians had more elevated aspirations. They dreamt not just of ruling the world, but of redeeming it. Yes, they did have a high standard of morality. And they didn't apologize for it. They felt like they had something good to take to this world. And today we apologize for that. Today we were embarrassed by those standards. Ferguson says it was no longer enough for them to exploit other races. Now the aim became to improve them. He talks about this change happening in the 1800s. And how significant is that, given the promises God made to Abraham, saying you're going to have an empire and the greatest single superpower ever? Of course, those promises were delayed, as we well know, until 1800 thereabouts. And then, right at that time, like Ferguson brings out in his history, it was no longer about exploiting other races. Now it was to improve them. Native peoples themselves would cease to be exploited, but their cultures, superstitious, backward, heathen, all of that would have to go. In particular, the Victorians aspired to bring light to what they called the Dark Continent. They wanted to bring light to Africa. They wanted to bring light to India. This other book, Heaven's Command by Jan Morris, speaking of India in particular, it says the Indian territories were allotted by Providence to Great Britain, wrote Charles Grant, the evangelical chairman of the East India Company's Court of Directors, not merely that we might draw an annual profit from them, but that we might diffuse among their inhabitants, long sunk in darkness, vice, and misery, the light and benign influence of the truth, the blessings of well-regulated society, the improvements and comforts of active industry. James Stephen wrote of the barbarous and obscene rites of Hindu superstition. And Wilberforce, that's the anti-slavery campaigner, declared the Christian mission in India to be the greatest of all causes. It quotes him as saying, "Let us endeavor to strike our roots into their soil by the gradual introduction and establishment of our own principles and opinions, of our laws, institutions, and manners even. Above all, as the source of every other improvement of our religion and consequently of our morals. We don't apologize for that. We want to bring them our religion. We want to expose them to the true God. We want to bring in the Holy Bible. We want them to have our morals. This same book by Jan Morris, they did, however, boldly set out to stifle the most offensive of native customs, however ancient, popular, or divinely rooted. They forbade human sacrifice and infanticide. You mean that was going on before the colonials arrived? Human sacrifice? Infanticide? They put down suti, the practice of burning widows, and henceforth, in their treaties with independent princes, insisted on its abolition as a condition of their protection. Though the custom was so fundamental to the Hindu moral order that its very name meant chaste or virtuous, they saw burning widows. The husband dies, and so then the widow is burned to death. They saw that as something that was chaste and virtuous. And the British came in and changed that. The British came in and said, no, that's outlawed. Slavery, that's outlawed. Child sacrifice, that's outlawed. And yes, homosexual activity, outlawed. And so here comes CNN, Washington Post, whoever else. I mean, they tell just a little tiny sliver of the story, implying that, oh, it would have been so much better had the empire never showed up, and then all of this stuff could have just continued on, presumably right to this day. I mean, anything goes, right? Isn't that what we want? Do whatever. If it feels good, do it. What a world. Jesus said in the last days, it would be just like it was in the days before the flood. It would be just like Sodom and Gomorrah. What a shame. Today, we look at all this history, so much of it inspiring history, and we want to apologize. Winston Churchill, I mean, he even brings out in his writing, this is from Marlborough, if you're educated the right way, I mean, you are going to advance and learn and understand more than you did a generation or two ago. But there's so many perversions and evils that have gotten so much worse than what it used to be. He said in Marlborough, it's important to remember also the differences of feeling and outlook which separate the men and women of those times from ourselves. He's writing about the English of the 17th and 18th centuries. This is the time just before it got its empire from God. And God was preparing it for empire, as my father has spoken before on Shakespeare and King James and Queen Elizabeth. Churchill's writing about the English from the 17th and early 18th centuries. What were they like? They gave a very high, indeed a dominating place in their minds to religion. It played as large a part in the life of the 17th century as sport does now. That's Churchill writing. I forget when he wrote Marlborough. I guess it was in the early 1900s. And he saw things about the 20th century that really disturbed him. I mean, he wasn't a religious man per se. But he certainly talked more about God than most give him credit for. And he said, where are we headed? And now, he wrote closer to World War II, now we're getting all of this technology. We're getting all of this advancement in weaponry. But we're not growing in character. We're not growing morally. This is dangerous to me. It seems dangerous. That's just paraphrasing some of his concerns from the early 20th century. Well, as I say, my father, he went through that in Shakespeare and the British Empire. I don't think I have time to get into. Maybe we could just move ahead to clip 4, Sam. This is from my father's program in February of this year, clip 4.
We have to have a certain amount of faith to endure in an empire. And really, it's very condemning history, I'll tell you, because there is a kind of a rot that has set in Britain and America. And why is that? There are, in America, you just have this great cauldron of evils. Why is that? What is causing it? What is the solution? Well, really, you can find it in Shakespeare even. You certainly can find it in the Bible, in all of our literature that we'll send to you to prove that to yourself. We are facing some great crises, and we have to understand that.
That's what he said in February of this year, the crises that we're facing, and then just this cauldron of evil. Even as we're so proud of who and what we are today, and even as we're so embarrassed and ashamed of what we once were, well, go back and listen to the entirety of that program, Shakespeare and the British Empire. We've played clips from it, I think, in programs every few weeks, it seems, over the last few months. But that's about all that we have time for on today's program. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you again tomorrow.